20,000 victims at its conclusion. The Icelandic sources Wagner preferred are, however, on a smaller scale, usually restricted to a few individuals on the stage at any one time. Wagner does have massed voices for the Gibichung vassals in Götterdämmerung, but most of the Ring cycle involves only two or three characters at a time on the stage. Tolkien also built his human drama around small scenes with only a few players. One can cite the long and complex relationship involving Frodo, Sam, and Gollum, but these alternate with gigantic scenes that would never fit on an operatic stage. Both epics end with the destruction of the ring. Brunhilde realizes at the last moment that this is the only solution, while Tolkien builds his entire plot around the quest to destroy the ring, something that can only be accomplished by penetrating deep into the land of the enemy. The quest is long, arduous, and very dangerous. The heroes seem good and the villains seem evil, but the borderline is often paper thin. Characters waver between the good and the evil worlds or fall prey to evil. Saruman, the great wizard who became a pawn of Sauron, Theoden, the king who allows himself to be dragged down to premature senility by the evil Wormtongue, Denethor, the steward of Gondor who despairs and commits suicide, Denethor's son Boromir, who tries to take the ring from Frodo by force and is shortly thereafter killed by orcs. Even Frodo spends much of the last half of the narrative in a losing battle against the power of the ring. All the figures of Tolkien's world are very close to the temptation to give in to Sauron and the temptation to power represented by the ring. Virtue is held upright in The Lord of the Rings by continuous exertion, and the temptation is always there to give in, to relax, and let events take their course. One would have to read very superficially to maintain that the characters in The Lord of the Rings are two-dimensional and lack complexity. The depiction of Sam's struggle with the power of the ring mentioned above should illustrate this. Wagner's characters seem most virtuous when they're following their inner nature, at least so when their behavior is determined by what Wagner called politics. In Die Walküre, Wotan is following his natural instinct until Fricka forces him to realize the political consequences of his all-too-natural actions. Political considerations cause him to condemn his own son, Siegmund, to death, and to eject his favorite daughter, Brunhilde, from the circle of the immortals. Siegfried does everything right as long as he follows nature, represented by the forest bird, but he ends up doing everything wrong when the power of human power politics takes over in Götterdämmerung. To be more precise, virtue is represented in Wagner largely by love, including sexual love, and vice is anything that violates that. Alberic's original curse, Wotan's sacrifice of his two dearest children, Siegfried's seduction by the memory potion, and so on. We might point out that the two brightest moments in the ring are when the heroes are about to make love to close relatives. A musicologist I know who loves Wagner is currently reading The Lord of the Rings, and he had two complaints. There is no sex, and everyone is always stopping for tea. He said this to contrast it with his positive response to Wagner. Like money, sex clearly played a larger role in Wagner's life than in Tolkien's. In fact, if it weren't for the very sexy English sitcom, Coupling, I might simply see Tolkien as an example of the often-cited show title, "No Sex Please, We're British." Virtue and vice reserved in other areas for Tolkien, as we have seen. On the other hand, I think we all see the virtue of a leisurely cup of tea or a glass of beer together with good company and good conversation. These are definite virtues for Tolkien. Tom Shippey, an Anglo-Saxonist who came to the defense of his older colleague, calls Tolkien an author of the century, referring to the 20th. He speaks of the many authors scarred by the wars and man-made catastrophes of the century and their inability to deal with them directly. Most of them needed many years, sometimes decades, to come to terms with their experience. Shippey cites the examples of Orwell, Golding, and Vonnegut, all of whom were combat veterans, who in their works of fiction, 1984, The Lord of the Flies, Slaughterhouse-Five, moved into the fantastic to express the horrors of those times. Shippey sees Tolkien as a representative of the damaged authors of the century. His giant works are his attempt to come to terms with the monstrosity of his own time. Wagner set out to shape his time, and in many ways the pivotal he was in many ways the pivotal figure of the 19th century. He invented a whole new kind of mythical art. He revolutionized music. He embodied the nationalism of the century and his focus on matters German. He portrayed the corruption of a plutocracy arising in his time, while at the same time demonstrating his own entrepreneurial spirit in his festival project at Bayreuth. In the intellectual and artistic world of Europe and America in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the time when Tolkien was growing up, Wagner was one of the central artistic touchstones. French Wagnerites like Baudelaire virtually worshipped him and his works. George Bernard Shaw, a generation older than Tolkien, was the intellectual leader of Wagnerians in England. Aubrey Beardsley produced a rich sequence of illustrations to Wagner's Ring that played a decisive role in C.S. Lewis's early infatuation. Wagner and his music became a prime mover in the rise of both opera and symphonic music in the Eastern metropolitan centers of New York. I should have just said simply in New York, in America. In Tolkien's generation, we find Wagner's positive and negative influence everywhere. T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland opens with a quote from Wagner's Tristan and Isolde. Richard Strauss and Giacomo Puccini wrote Wagnerian operas, while Stravinsky and his school violently rejected Wagner's influence and were thus shaped negatively by the same forces. The bridge between the world of Wagnerianism and Tolkien's circle in Oxford was C.S. Lewis, an ardent Wagnerian. Lewis was a lecturer in English at Oxford during most of Tolkien's career there, and the two men became close friends. Lewis is famous for his works of popular theology, his interplanetary trilogy, and probably most of all for his Chronicles of Narnia. I've read but been unable to confirm in primary sources that Lewis and Tolkien regularly attended performances of The Ring in London, a fact that Tolkien and his biographers generally forget. Humphrey Carpenter, Tolkien's official biographer, wrote a history of the Inklings, that informal group in Oxford that included both Lewis and Tolkien, which mentions Wagner only twice, but both instances are telling. The first involves a dramatic reading of Die Walküre, who was this undertaken in 1934 by Lewis, Tolkien, and Lewis's brother Warney, who is the source for this episode. Both Lewis and Tolkien wanted to read the work in the original German, but Warney's inability to keep up with him in that language forced them to read it in the English translation. Reportedly, the three continued their discussion of the opera until very late. Carpenter also cites Tolkien's daughter Priscilla as his source for an incident in which Lewis and Tolkien attended a performance of a Ring opera in London without the requisite evening dress and were the only men in the audience committing that faux pas. If Tolkien had never heard of Wagner, if the Ring of the Nibelung had not been a part of every young man's education in the first quarter of the 20th century, if his best friend had not been a powerful Wagnerian, then we might believe that Tolkien had derived some, if not all, of these aspects from other sources. But the evidence is overwhelming. Tolkien stands convicted of being a closet Wagnerian. How do we explain Tolkien's virulent reaction of Wagner as a source? Let me draw a last parallel. In the early 1840s, Wagner was a virtually unknown composer and conductor who was seeking his fortune in Paris, the opera capital of Europe. An older, more established, and financially successful figure in the field helped him with introductions, found him work to keep bread on the table, and eventually arranged for the production of Rienzi in Dresden, which was Wagner's first real success as a composer. That production led to his being appointed conductor in Dresden with a comfortable, if not lavish, income. Wagner also learned a great deal from the operas of the older composer. Wagner's strong sense of indebtedness led to his total rejection of the older composer, Giacomo Meyerbeer. His resentment at owing his career to another was a component of his violent anti-Semitism and led to his use of Meyerbeer to represent all that was wrong with opera and with European culture as a whole. Wagner also conveniently forgot that Heinrich Heine, another German Jew, was a major source for his Flying Dutchman. With the exception of Franz Liszt and King Ludwig of Bavaria, virtually everyone who really helped Wagner along the way was treated in the same shabby way. Tolkien was certainly not as petty a man as Wagner. but I sense in his rejection of Wagner a similar refusal to accept the fact that he had learned so much from Wagner's mythopoiesis and from his art as a whole. This refusal may not have been conscious, but it was powerful. Although Tolkien and Wagner may have had different attitudes toward religion, politics, and many other things, they shared a notion of a grand mythic design drawn from their Germanic past and expressed in an old-fashioned version of the language of their own day as a means of exploring the nature of evil and the struggle against it. The resemblance between the two great ring cycles does not end with the shape of their central symbols. Thank you.